Intellectual Muscle, University Dialogues for Vancouver 2010. Vancouver, the 6th North American Winter Games. What does history tell us about hosting the Olympics? These are the questions asked by Dr. Kevin Walmsley, Acting Dean of the Faculty of Health Sciences and former Director of the International Center for Olympic Studies at the University of Western Ontario.
Vancouver Olympics are the 6th Winter Games to be hosted on North American snow since their modest beginnings in 1924 in Chamonix, France. Visions of skiing, skating, and sledding on crisp winter days were far removed from the narratives about ancient Greek Olympic athletes, adorned by sweat, oil, and symbolic olive leaves conjured up for the inauguration of the modern Olympic Games in 1896. However, when the Winter Games were first introduced to the Olympic cycle, the modern Olympic idea had already been strategically positioned in the minds of many and widely accepted. No nostalgic connections to ancient Greece were necessary. Considering that Pierre de Coubertin himself and one of his most prominent successors, Avery Brundage, were not enthusiastic about the Winter Games, their historical significance rests beyond a mere compliment to the summer festival. Certainly the establishment of Winter Olympic competitions signaled a specific reining in of Nordic sports valued by some internationally influential countries, but the reification of Olympiana within broader sporting and cultural relations was more important. The International Olympic Committee, the IOC, had solidified its administrative and ideological significance over and influence over international sporting culture in the 1920s. Alternative multi-sport festivals, including the Women's Olympics, Workers' Olympics, and the Nordic Games, were all dismantled by the next decade. Coubertin's fears that winter sports were too select by country were warranted, but notions that another festival would detract from the Olympic celebrations originally conceived proved to be wrong. Indeed, the Winter Olympic Games tightened the IOC's hold on international sport through its association with international sport federations and, of course, athletes by the doubling of public and media exposure offered in multiple host cities. Coubertin's insistence that the Olympic Games be ambulatory was significant in the legitimizing process that was manifested through organized sport during the 20th century. The success and popularity of the Olympics only heightened with each new host city. In the first instance, and national and local engagements with the Olympic idea and with the sporting and cultural infrastructure of the Coubertinian Games was fundamental. However, an additional legitimizing function obtained in the local interpretation of the Games. Local meanings and identifications, unique by virtue of country, region, or ethnicity, were infused into the experience of the Games by organizers, supporters, and visitors. Such unique engagements at personal or civic levels, whether positive or negative in association, only served to legitimize Coubertin's Olympiana in idea, form, or both. Having two Olympic festivals in a four-year cycle, then, extended the scope of the sports process. The selection of host cities for the first few games, Athens, Paris, London, Stockholm, was astutely political to ensure the success of the festival. All locations had noteworthy connections to sport or the current sport leadership. Coubertin sought out worldly cities, a testament to the pervasive influence, indeed the enveloping multimedia presence of the Olympics in the 20th century. Less than 100 years later, the relationship has been inverted. Bid committees now claim that winning the rights to host an Olympic Games is invariably announcing the arrival of a world-class city. The chosen cities must have massive infrastructures in place for the influx of athletes and media personnel, including large airports, hotel complexes, and state-of-the-art athletic facilities. Cities hosting the Winter Olympics have always been significantly different than their summer counterparts, with unique environmental requirements. In addition to cold weather, the most predominant feature, of course, was immediate access to a mountain of significant slope for alpine skiing events. Consequently, without exception, all winter host cities were tourist resorts of some regional, national, or international standing. The first Olympic foray to North America, St. Louis, in 1904, was tenuous at best. Coubertin did not even attend the Games. However, the Games hosted in North America during the rest of the century, both summer and winter, are considered to be relatively successful, on the terms of Olympic organizers and supporters, of course. So much so that the American television market in the last quarter of the 20th century has ensured the financial stability of the IOC for the foreseeable future. Hosting the Olympic Games has always been challenging for organizers, who are charged with the task of superimposing an institutionalized model on local turf, a process that usually pits boosters against critics, capital development against social concerns. With the exception of Denver, Colorado, where environmentally concerned voters rejected state funding for the 1976 Winter Games, the Olympic boosters have won the day. The first North American city to host the Winter Games was Lake Placid, New York, in 1932, followed by Squaw Valley, California, in 1960, Lake Placid in 1980, Calgary, Alberta, 1988, Salt Lake City, Utah, 2002, and Vancouver, 2010. Of all issues emerging from the hosting of these games, without question, the most fundamental and contentious across the decades has been financing. Projections for Vancouver suggest that up to $6 billion in public money will be doled out. Without question, the most significant changes with direct consequences to host cities occurred under the Juan Antonio Samaranch regime. The scope of spectacle has been magnified, to say the least, by millions of dollars in sponsorship emanating from lucrative television contracts and corporate marketing programs. As a result, the celebrations have become more extravagant, but the public debt has not been eliminated. In this era, protests against the Olympics have become more organized and extensive. Unique and compelling issues have emerged for each winter host city. It goes without saying that all have been bound and influenced by the social, economic, and political particulars of each historic era, both within Olympic culture and beyond to local, national, and international contexts. As early as 1932, protesters challenged the Olympic Organizing Committee in Lake Placid over the cutting of 2,500 trees in the protected Adirondacks region of New York to make way for the Olympic bobsleigh track. Support in the State Assembly for such considerations was abetted by the Organizing Committee's impressive list of honorary and active members, including, among others, Franklin Roosevelt, Governor of New York, General Douglas MacArthur, past president, American Olympic Committee, Dr. Godfrey Dewey, Vice President, Lake Placid Club, and William J. O'Hare, who served as treasurer of the Winter Games Committee. An influential slate of patrons and associates was crucial to the allocation of public funds in excess of $1 million to build adequate facilities. Low attendance figures produced gate receipts of only $93,000, leaving public costs financed mainly by the state legislature of just fewer than $1 million. These costs seem minimal by current standards, but only 364 athletes participated in Lake Placid. And these costs were borne by the public purse, in spite of the harsh economic climate of the Great Depression during the decade of the 1930s. Speed skater Jack Shea, a resident of New York State, won the first medal in Lake Placid and became the first Olympic athlete to mount a podium, now a permanent fixture in the ritual ceremonies of the Games. Shea's Olympic experiences in 1932 became an important point of departure for the recent celebrations in Salt Lake City 70 years later, which involved his grandson. A resident of Lake Placid, Jack Shea became a local icon, a living connection to Lake Placid's Olympic history. In all Winter Olympic Games, particularly in the first half of the century, when the majority of facilities were outdoors, weather was always a major concern. In Lake Placid in 1932, a thaw followed by a heavy snowstorm wreaked havoc upon the bobsled run, and teams of workers had to be called in for major repairs. United States ski jumping tryouts could not even be held in Lake Placid because there was no snow. The 50-kilometer track had to be remarked because most of the snow had melted from the course. Such facilities as the Lake Placid bobsleigh track remained temporary, leaving only limited responsibilities in caring for the permanent structures, such as the indoor arena for the host town or city. As the Olympic Games grew, in terms of athlete participation and in the scope of facilities considered necessary for hosting a successful Games, post-Olympic costs eventually became a primary concern for organizing committees. Providing an infrastructure superlative to the previous Games became as much a part of Olympic competition between host cities, particularly in the symbolic cultural context of the Cold War period, as the prerogative of setting world records became an index of progress for athletes, coaches, and national sport programs. Elaborate, even unique sport facilities emerged as an unexpected feature of the Olympic experience, to be invoked as an impressionistic gauge of the host city, organizing committee, and, of course, to the broader audience, the Games themselves. Well before 1960, when the Winter Games returned to North America, the Olympics had firm footing as the most important multi-sport festival in the world. Unfortunately for host cities, cost continued to escalate. Building the Olympic facilities for 1960 in Squaw Valley, California, including Blythe Arena, the Olympic Village, on-site hospital, press building, upgrades to the ski courses, interstate highway expansion, and airport improvements, drove the costs to $20 million. The state of Nevada shared some costs, as did U.S. Congress, but most were absorbed by the state of California, whose leaders planned to sell off these holdings after the games. Television rights infused only $50,000 into the budget. Organizers even canceled the sport of bobsleighing to avoid the costs of building a track. Plans to offer a modest non-commercial games quickly fell by the wayside as Walt Disney was appointed pageant director and celebrity Art Linkletter provided nightly entertainment in the village. In what Ashwell has called an artfully created artificial environment, Disney's giant plaster athlete sculptures towered above the elaborate ceremonies and entertainments. A glossing over of the U.S. ban on visas for East German journalists, the ever-present two-China issue, and the running tensions between the United States and Soviet nationalisms. American athletes did not disappoint, with the gold medal performance of the U.S. men's hockey team making the biggest impression. In the end, the Squaw Valley Games were heralded as an Olympic success. However, the $20 million infrastructure, the majority of the cost met by public money, fell into disrepair. Even subsidies for private developers could not sustain the facilities. The new television audiences of the 1960s had changed the productive capacities of Olympic Games. On-site events were transformed into the precursors of mega events, and artificial spectacles, such as that staged in Squaw Valley, were cast more as entertainment for the new enlarged audiences, dressing the Coubertinian sport infrastructure in new clothes. The decade of the 1970s was a period of transition for the Olympics, particularly after the departure of the ultra-conservative Avery Brundage as IOC president. The Munich Massacre in 1972, the financial disaster of the Montreal Games of 1976, the decline of the rules of amateurism under the leadership of Lord Kalanin, and the peak of rivalry between the United States and the Soviet Union had placed the Olympics in a precarious position. There were few cities willing to host an Olympic Games. However, under Kalanin's successor, Juan Antonio Samaranch, after the 1980 Games, all things changed. 20 years after Squaw Valley, on U.S. soil once again, Cold War politics pulsed through the Winter Games in Lake Placid. From the Kennedy to the Carter era, through competitions over outer space, science, culture, and the economy, the symbolic weight of Olympic victory for nations only magnified. Most significant for the U.S., beyond the debts and exorbitant costs of facilities, the fears of boycott, court injunctions by Taiwan for official status at the Games, and a squashed environmental protest, was the gold medal victory of the men's hockey team, coined the Miracle on Ice. Capitalizing once again on the IOC's ambivalence towards the commercialization of the Olympics, the Lake Placid organizers promised to deliver unspectacular, simple games. Environmental concerns, raised initially some 48 years earlier in Lake Placid, came to the fore again. Commercial developments were not to be undertaken in the Adirondacks region. In the end, although the construction process was delayed somewhat, the environmental protests were, for the most part, silenced through legislation. The organizing committee also came under investigation by the federal government for financial irregularities. In particular, the awarding of construction contracts and the millions of dollars of deficits accrued in the process. The initial grossly underestimated budget was projected at $22 million. The final budget ballooned to $150 million. Television revenues and ticket sales provided only $34 million. The federal and state governments granted the rest. In spite of innovative plans for facilities, such as the conversion of the Olympic Village into a federal prison after the Games, the city of Lake Placid was left with a $4.3 million deficit and $21.5 million in claims filed by contractors. During the Games, transportation became a major issue for the Lake Placid Organizing Committee. Some spectators had to travel hours to reach the venues because of a housing shortage in the town. Since only the athletes, town residents, and Olympic officials were permitted to drive into Lake Placid, the majority of spectators had to be bused in from parking lots 10 miles away. During the Games, bus problems and road conditions stranded thousands of spectators at the venues. Infrastructural problems, however, were quickly overshadowed by events in the Games. For the White House, where Jimmy Carter remained poised to deal with the pressing issues of the day, American athletes quickly became national heroes. Only the victory of the Americans over the Soviet hockey team on George Washington's birthday overshadowed Eric Heiden's brilliant 5 gold medal speed skating performances. The value of these victories in distracting attention away from the financial difficulties of the Games was immeasurable. Following the resounding financial success of Peter Ueberot's Olympic Games in Los Angeles in 1984, the realization that the Games could turn a substantial profit, cities worked with more fervor to bid for the Olympics. And more significantly, new President Samaranch ushered in an era of commercially determined relationships with multinational corporations, which in addition to a windfall in television broadcast revenues, created new sources of finance for host cities. Calgary in 1988 was the first Olympic host city to enjoy the exaggerated base of television revenues. Broadcasters had paid some $20.7 million to televise the Winter Games in Lake Placid in 1980. Slick negotiating tactics by the IOC raised the stakes to $324 million for Calgary just 8 years later. Annual home to the internationally renowned Calgary Stampede Rodeo since the early part of the 20th century, the city was well versed in staging sports entertainment. The Olympics, however, were a major event for the city. Given the opportunities, more often requirements of the Olympics to showcase local and national culture for the period leading up to and including the Games, event leaders in cities such as Calgary were forced to consider the idea of local and regional, even national heritage, and the representations of culture that would be positioned for all of the Olympic celebrations. As part of its long-term economic development, city leaders had to position Calgary as a modern city with all of the business opportunities of a world-class city. Basic infrastructural requirements such as an international airport and adequate numbers of hotel rooms aside, the costs of building Winter Olympic facilities were enormous. The Calgary Saddle Dome, modern emblem of Calgary's Western heritage, cost $98 million. The Olympic Oval and Olympic Village facilities, $103 million. Ski jump, bobsleigh, and luge facilities and training centers, $72 million. Nordic Center, $17 million. Alpine facilities, $27 million. The Olympic program, the top program, which was the exclusive sponsorship revenues, broadcast revenues, and national sponsorship monies, were buffered by more than $500 million in support from the federal, provincial, and city governments. The IOC corporate funding schemes assured the financial security of the Olympics at a time when host cities were reluctant to come forward. Yet, substantial public funds were still being expended on the elaborate ceremonies, IOC luxuries, and costly facilities. Corporate relationships were being sought for all aspects of the Games, including rituals and ceremonies. The oil and gas company Petro-Canada, for example, sponsored the torch relay. Strategically, corporate colors were red and white, matching the Canadian flag and typical Canadian Olympic uniforms. The cost of the torch relay was $50 million, involving 6,520 participants, selected from 6.5 million applicants. The share of the torch run, aided by boat, snowmobile, and dog sled, brought increased revenues of $23 million per month to the company. As the torch made its way across Canada, protests were staged in Ganawage, Toronto, Edmonton, Lethbridge, and Calgary in support of the Lubicon Cree, a band of Aboriginal Canadians who organized a boycott of the Olympics as part of their political engagement over land claims and the long-term suffering at the hands of discriminatory government policies. Aboriginals and their supporters protested against the sponsorship of the Games by oil companies, particularly against the Spirit Sings exhibition at the Glenbow Museum in Calgary. The exhibition featured hundreds of artifacts solicited from collections situated around the world that had been stolen or appropriated from North America. Typical media representations depicted Canadian Aboriginals as the romanticized wild savages remembered by colonial tales of the 18th and 19th centuries. For example, officials wanted to include a Native Canadian history within the ceremonials of the 1976 Olympics, but neglected to seek the input of Aboriginals. In 1976, in Montreal, hundreds of non-natives were dressed in Aboriginal costumes and adorned with face paint for the closing ceremonies. After Montreal, Native leaders ensured that any future participation or thematic representations in national or international events would have their approval. In the end, the Calgary Olympics were judged to be a tremendous success, capped by Samaranch's praise as the best Games ever. With such extensive private and public funding, the organizing committee was able to bank a legacy fund to ensure the upkeep of facilities post-Games. In the years that followed, however, the Olympic mark remained a prominent feature of the city landscape. Long-term tourist figures did not reach the proportions that are always projected in Olympic bids, but the Olympic City projection figured extensively in Calgary's tourist promotion plans. An outcome of the Winter Games successes has been a stream of international sporting and cultural events that Calgary has bid for, won, and hosted in its post-Games era. Frequently, these facilities host national and international events. Further, the prestige of hosting non-Olympic international events has lured the interest of civic boosters and corporate sponsors alike. Some of the Calgary Olympic facilities have been well used, while others incur significant maintenance costs with few users. The Olympic Oval at the University of Calgary is arguably the biggest success story of the 1988 Winter Games. It has been marketed as a multi-use facility for elite athletes from around the world and for local residents who wish to speed skate, play hockey, run, or attend national and international events. The ski jumps, bobsleigh, luge, and skeleton tracks, however, are far less appropriate for public use. Those in favor of sustaining elite performance centers for national caliber athletes can easily make the case for these facilities. Salt Lake City, too, has wrestled and will continue to wrestle with similar issues of competing identities and representations of culture. Unique to Salt Lake has been the media attention in the wake of the IOC bribery scandal and the concerns over safety in light of the attacks on the World Trade Centers and Pentagon on September 11, 2001. Although bribery and scandal within the IOC had been extant in Olympic business long before Salt Lake, the city will have to endure its historic association with bribery and graft for the foreseeable future. The Olympic story has not played out for Vancouver yet. However, similar financial issues have been at the forefront of debates since the bid was won in 2003. IOC television and top sponsorship revenues present a near-balanced operating budget, but billions of dollars of public money have been expended on infrastructure. The political climate in the region is ripe for anti-Olympic protests and demonstrations, in spite of attempts to clamp down on the freedom of speech. Even the Winter Games have now grown to such magnitude that an entire city will be captive to Olympic events and celebrations for a two-week period. The influx of people and the infrastructural requirements of the Games have been and will continue to be a major draw on financial and human resources. But for that brief period, as per usual, the cost will temporarily be forgotten, and people will talk about the weather, the traffic, and eventually the athletes at these sixth Olympic Winter Games on North American snow.
Intellectual Muscle was developed by Vancouver 2010, UBC Continuing Studies in collaboration with universities across Canada, and the Globe and Mail.